Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Well, one of the biggest ogre-like nutterers of the group, Rex Heuermann, stood in a Suffolk County courtroom, hands shackled behind his back, and admitted to taking the lives of 8 women across a killing spree that lasted from 1993 all the way to 2010. After nearly 3 years of maintaining his innocence after he was caught, but if you're looking at the full timeline of living a life, we're talking almost four decades of maintaining that innocence. The man prosecutors called the Gilgo Beach serial killer has changed his plea, guilty on all counts. In a hearing that lasted roughly 30 minutes. It was quick. It was in. It was out. Families of the women he killed wept as he spoke very bluntly, very plainly. Yes, he pled guilty. His own estranged wife and daughter sat in the back row. But a guilty plea isn't the same as answers. And the questions this case leaves behind may be more unsettling than the ones that it actually resolved. We're going to go through this in two parts today. We're first going to talk about Heuermann's guilty plea and exactly what happens next. And then in our next part of the conversation, we will dive deeper into the area of Asa Elrup, his wife. She made a statement at the end, a lawsuit that has now come up against her and her daughter. And the questions that people have there, not to accuse or anything of that nature, but just to discuss everything that's going on around this case. So joining us this morning to have this conversation, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, and of course, my co-host, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. Eric, let's start here. Heuermann he pled guilty to 7 murders and admitted to killing an 8th woman as well, Karen Vergata. This was one that had been kind of sitting there in the ether. Like, is it going to be tagged onto him? And at the last moment, it was. But it was as part of a deal, but not formally charged with her death. So he admits to it, but not formally charged. Help us understand. My first question is literally kind of the dynamics of what this actually is. As a former prosecutor, walk us through what that trade actually looks like behind closed doors. And what did prosecutors get in exchange for not charging him with Vergata's murder? And did her family just get shortchanged?
Yeah, Tony, it's rather unusual to build into a plea that a person is going to admit to a crime but never be charged or convicted of that crime. You know, is it sort of lip service to the family? I hate to put it that way, but trying to have some modicum of accountability without real accountability legally, it's rather unusual. And so what are prosecutors getting out of it? I guess they're getting out of it some closure, hopefully, for the victim's family in terms of what happened to this person. But no legal charge, no legal conviction. A little strange.
So what does that mean to the case itself of Vergata's case? If there's not a conviction, if there's not a charge, is it a cold case? Is it just, I mean, how does it get classified going forward in a legal, because I mean, there's got to be a mark on this on the file somewhere.
Yeah, I would imagine that it's just like a closed case at this time without any legal resolution. Now, it seems like there is a admitted factual resolution, but quite unusual. And you know, I can't imagine where that family's at with that. Is this satisfying to them? Does this, you know, bring what they're looking for? And I'm just not sure about that.
Yeah, and Eric, still the striking thing with all this, as all these things are with Heuermann, is what is he getting out of this? Because, again, death was never on the table, and the only thing I can still think of is the currency is knowledge aspect of it. What are you legally thinking that his defense team was able to get in some sort of benefit, if anything, except notoriety for Heuermann?
Hearman's attorney did make a statement after the plea hearing and essentially said the reason Hurlman did this was to not put the victims' families through the horrible crucible of trial, whether that was a real motivation or not, that's questionable, to not put his own family through the gruesome details of what these acts that he committed. But I think also that, things were just mounting against him. He lost this important motion trying to exclude the DNA evidence. And I think that might have been the nail in the coffin, and perhaps he was just kind of tired of fighting. But there's no real tangible legal or otherwise benefit that he's getting from this. And the sentence is kind of a foregone conclusion at this point.
I know. And everyone's got to remember, there is zero motivation for anyone who is so psychopathic to do any act of kindness for any other human being, because why would he? It's not in his DNA. So this was totally self-serving to me, and give him zero credit for anything he did.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, and sometimes we think really deep on these folks, and sometimes there is a lot of real complex, weird thinking that goes on, and it takes, some mind power to try and get there, trying to get behind. But sometimes these folks operate very simply. I mean, sometimes it's very childlike. And if you look at Hearman, in a lot of ways, he is very childlike. I mean, I go back to thinking of like a child. My thought is, like, I remember playing Monopoly as a kid. Very contentious game, it seems. There were a lot of us in childhood where, sometimes people cheat. They're the banker. They're this, they're that. But I remember playing Monopoly against people. And sometimes you'd get the kid that you get so far into the game, you spend hours doing it all this time. And then, like, the deck is stacked against them because they made bad choices, or just because it's the luck of the draw. It's how the game went. And then, there's maybe another hour to play. Like, I quit. I'm done. I'm out. That kind of reminds me of what Hearman is doing. And they don't care. And everybody's like, "What? We got to get to the resolution here. I quit. You guys can win." And they don't care about anybody else's time and effort that was put into this. They're just, that's the best thing for them. And then, this is what I think is interesting. We have an interesting element of Hearman's plea that we learned about the other day. The FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit is going to jump in here with him. He's agreed to cooperate with them, which is interesting. I don't know if he watched too much Mindhunter and now he's thinking, great, I get to be in part two or what. But it feels like, I'm wondering if that's been a motivation of the kid who wants to quit the game, and then another group in here says, we want to learn why you want to quit the game. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's great the FBI can get in there and learn shit from him, but I think that might be more the modality of his thinking of why he's quitting the game. And it's not necessarily for the benefit of his family or the victims. It's because, guess what? There's a new spotlight that's coming your way from the FBI. Remember that TV show, that series that everybody talks about where these people become more famous for doing horrible things? You get to be one of their next stars. That might be his motivation.
And if I could add on to that and then put it to Eric for a question, if he's seen this before, because I was asked this on another show this morning I was interviewed for, and that is, they were going in anyway.
Yeah, true.
I mean, the BAU, part of the big thing that the profilers do is they do research, and they do research by interviewing everyone they can get access to. So regardless of whether it was part of a plea agreement or not, you really think they weren't going to try to interview Hearman? Do you think they weren't going to make those attempts? They were always going to make those attempts, because every single, so inside the Bureau, there's multiple BAU units, one, two, three, four, that actually focus on different types of crimes against adults. And then you have one for crimes against children. Mm-hmm. And each of them does research in these areas, because that's where the profiling comes from this research in all these areas. And so it was almost like an overplay of cards to saying, hey, look, I'm doing this. Like you said, Tony, I think this was about notoriety, not about reality, because they were going to go in anyway. Now, will they have, because again, do you really think he is going to give more or less information based on this plea agreement? He's still going to try playing with him. He's still, remember, his only currency is information. And if he gives up everything without trying to get something in reciprocity, he has no currency left. So I don't like giving him credit for giving access, or his team access, that they were going to get anyway. Because here's what happens psychologically. he's going to be in isolation for quite a while, if not a longer quite a while. Mm-hmm. When you have limited access to human beings, the need to communicate and share your story of how grandiose and how awesome you are builds exponentially. And if all of a sudden someone comes in to hear your story, do you really think he's going to say, go away? Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but
yeah.
But the question then to Eric is, Eric, have you seen that as part of plea agreements often, and or is it common, not common?
I would say it's very uncommon to build that into the plea agreement. Like you said, sometimes those things happen after a person is incarcerated just organically. But to build that into a part of this legal document is also somewhat unusual. And I think, yeah, you guys are both right that this is his chance to sort of live in infamy. And I think, Robin, too, that he's gonna play a sick game during some of these interviews. I think he's going to give little breadcrumbs here and there. But withhold some information because that is the way he maintains that control. And so this could be a long series of interviews over the course of years.
Yeah.
And Robin, I agree. I mean, they would have gone in regardless, but I wonder if they use it as a carrot on a stick where it's like, you're going to go in regardless. And maybe Huerman doesn't know that, but he thinks maybe it makes him more special. I'm curious as to how that even came into the equation where it was like, was it brought up and like somebody noticed he really perks up when somebody mentions this, like, what if we build that in? What if we use that as the, to inspire him to plead here, because we're going to like make him think, make him feel like he's special, like he's really worth studying. And maybe that will be enough motive for him to put him over the edge and say, I did it, so we don't have to go through this trial and all this rigmarole and everything. I'm wondering if it was kind of, I mean, it's like a child. It's like, if you're really good, we'll get ice cream on the way home.
You know, Tony, you are so spot on. I got my goosebumps going because I think that if they did that, I think that is a genius move.
I think it was.
I think so too. So here's the lever you could use. It's a lever of influence on Huerman. It's the lever of notoriety.
Yeah.
And when you can say, Dennis Rader didn't get this deal, but you're getting this deal if you do this X, Y, and Z. That's like a lever of notoriety.
Exactly. And it's bullshit, but it's if you can make them, if they want to believe it, they can believe it all they want. But in reality, it's not true. It's like, but if that's what gets you to just fess up to this and take accountability and everybody can move the F on, then let's pull it.
Anyone ever watched the sitcom The Office?
Mm-hmm.
And in the office, Dwight's the assistant to the regional manager, which means nothing. That's what this is.
No, I think you're exactly right. Eric, investigators found what they described as the blueprint for the killings in Huerman's computer checklist, reminding him to. I mean, it was a ridiculous list. It was things where you're going to go do this, and you need this on paper to limit noise, clean the bodies, destroy evidence. I mean, this wasn't necessarily impulsive. Like, if he actually, I got to clean them. I mean, this was methodical. I mean, if you had been the prosecutor walking this case into trial, how do you present that document to a jury without letting the horror of it overshadow any sort of legal strategy? I mean, it feels like it's a pretty good slam dunk, but there is no slam dunks in a case like this.
Yeah, you know, in a case like this, you have to prove after deliberation, you have to prove this was premeditated, that he thought about it in advance, he planned it out, and that blueprint is Exhibit 1. I mean, look, it talks about supplies that are needed. It talks about protocol. It talks about what he's going to do to the bodies and also talks about problems to address to try and avoid detection. I can't think of a better piece of evidence to show that this was well thought out. It was not something that just happened spur of the moment during some dispute with these escorts or something. This was methodical and calculated. And yeah, that's Exhibit 1.
Yeah. One of the things that has come out, his attorney said that pleading has given his client a great sense of relief. Him, a huge sense of relief. Huerman's attorney. What do you think that relief is? Relief that his... his methodical, like we were just talking about, his planning documents, because he was so detailed in everything. The fact that that's not going to be exposed in court as the cluster F that it is, or is it that he's relieved that now he, in his mind, with the BAU coming in, he can control the narrative. He can control what version of his story he tells to people, and it's not being told by a district attorney in a courtroom. Now, granted, people can see through it, but he doesn't think that far ahead. He's just caring about what's coming out of his mouth. Is that the relief you think that he's feeling? Where do you think, what type of relief and why do you think he's feeling relief, if he is at all?
Yeah, in my impression, it's something along those lines. It's that, and I think Mark Frye commented earlier something similar, that he still gets to keep his secrets, or at least he's the gatekeeper of those secrets still. Mm-hmm. And that includes, you know, the details about motivation. That includes how he selected these folks and what he did and sort of the gruesome goriness of all of that. That's something he gets to keep, and he's going to be able to share it at his discretion when he feels like it. He might share part of it. He might share another part another day. And so he maintains that control, and he will maintain that control indefinitely. And so this sort of allows him to still kind of be on top in his mind, in the sense that, you know, not all of my dirty laundry, not all of my skeletons, forgive the pun, are going to be disclosed. I'm going to be in control of all of that, and I will remain in control, even with the FBI, as the years go by.
Yeah, I love that statement, gatekeeper of his secrets. That's what he's still maintaining. I hate when guys like this win. So, I still think this is a win for him. He's not subjected to cross. He's not subjected to having all his secrets exposed, not at his discretion, but someone else's.
I mean, excuse me. Any evidence that was against him that would have been presented at trial will eventually kind of come out here.
Yes.
Excuse me, just as we saw with Koberger in the weeks and months after that, it's just not going to be presented in the, on the stage, on a courtroom stage, as it would. Michael Brown, defense attorney, he says he expects Hearman will have something to say at sentencing in June, which might be interesting. I mean, this kind of harkens back in my mind to BTK when he did his whole spiel in detail for like an hour in Wichita, saying, here's what I did, how I did it in great detail. What do you think we might see here in June? Obviously, we saw the quick plea the other day of, yes, I did it, and he's guilty on those charges. He didn't go into any other detail, but usually sentencing is where we're going to get victim impact statements and also a statement possibly from the defendant, if in fact he chooses to give one. Do you think we're going to see something here?
So at sentencing, Tony, every defendant has what's called a right to allocution. So they have a right to sort of make a statement and say their piece. Is that what he's going to do? Was this sort of some foreshadowing that sort of tickles Hurlman in the sense that he's got a future spotlight? He's still going to be the star of the show. And hey, you guys all should wait with bated breath as to what he's going to say. This is going to be about him. And I'm just wondering if that's sort of the impression that I got from the statement of his attorney. You know, will he go into details? Will he talk at length, or will it be something very limited? It's a little hard to say at this point. My guess is that it might be something a little more limited, like, I'm sorry for my actions and the harm that I caused. Who knows? It could be an hour-long rant like Raider.
Yeah. I'm really hoping that the families, when they give their victim impact statements, talk to the Gonzalez family and the statement they made at Koberger's sentencing, because they eviscerated him. And I hope these families get up there and don't allow him to be the hero, don't allow him to be center stage, but they eviscerate him up there because that's what he deserves.
I wonder if Hearman is capable of feeling it. I think Olivia Gonzalez got to Koberger.
Yeah. There was
some reaction there for a person that we look at Koberger, and before she gave her speech, I would have said, I don't think anybody's going to get through to him, no matter what. I don't think there's anything, but everybody has a pain point somewhere. And it's on people like this. It's not usually where one would expect it to be, because they don't operate like us. So the things that would hurt us if we were to hear them are not the same things for them, but she knew how to dig into there. I wonder if Huerman has a pain point, or if, I mean, he's much older than Koberger, so more, far less green in this world. I just wonder if there's a lever left to reach Huerman on that level. What do you think, Robin?
I think so. I think because they're very similar in the sense that Koberger, theories by many, including myself, was that he was a serial killer in making, mm-hmm. but just sucked so bad at it, he got caught after the first. Mm-hmm. I think the pain points are very similar on this. And I think some of the things, one of the reasons why Siobhan Scott said the other day was that he targeted Elsa for recruitment / wife was because she idolized him. Yeah. She saw him as the knight in shining armor. If someone goes in there and diminishes what that viewpoint of her was to him and that how he wasn't a man to anyone, just like they did with Koberger, I think that could be a potential pain point to hit.
Yeah. I could definitely see that being a point. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue this part of the conversation right there. There's another part to this story. While Rex Huerman was admitting to 8 murders inside a Suffolk County courtroom, his estranged wife, or ex-wife, Asa Elrup, was sitting in the last row watching the man she was married to for nearly 3 decades confess to things she has publicly said she never believed he was capable of. She's called him her hero during this whole process. She walked outside then and told reporters her thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families. But Elrup isn't just a spectator anymore. There's a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the son of victim Valerie Mack that now names her and her daughter Victoria as defendants, accusing them of knowing about the killings, profiting from a documentary deal reportedly worth over $1 million, and showing disregard for the families of the women Rex Huerman killed. There's an interesting angle over here. And again, in no way am I accusing Victoria or Asa of having knowledge of any of this. I want to be very clear about that as we get into it. But it is a point of this case, and we're going to discuss it. Asa was married to him for nearly 3 decades. She lived in that house, roughly 1,300 square feet, not a big place, where investigators found a basement vault behind a large door containing hundreds of weapons and other stuff, other places they weren't allowed to go into. The wrongful death lawsuit says it's impossible that she didn't know something was happening in that house. Eric, as someone who has prosecuted violent crimes that have happened inside homes, do you believe that a wife can live in a space that small and not know something is deeply wrong?
Certainly, there's a theoretical possibility that she did not know. You know, when you look at the facts, if you look at for how long this went on, you look at what was found inside the home in which she lived for years and years, and you're talking about her spouse, right? The person presumably she is closest to, or at least extremely close to. It's possible that she didn't know. What I think is probably more likely is that she may have had some inclination. She may have had some suspicion. She may have seen some stuff that raised some eyebrows where she's saying, hey, that's not right. This is bizarre. But does that rise to the level of like actual knowledge of what Rex was doing in terms of brutally offing these women? Mm-hmm. I wonder if it's just somewhere in between actual knowledge and no knowledge at all. Where that would fall on that spectrum is going to be investigated in this case.
I'm curious, Eric, and forgive me because I don't remember exactly whose hair DNA was here, there, and everywhere. But I do remember, and Tony, you probably remember more than I do. Wasn't Asa's hair also found commingled on like the duct tape?
On the burlap and the daughter's that were both found on some burlap. I mean, the daughter would have been like 3 years old at the time. I mean, the house was a hoarder house, so it's any reasonable person can look at the house and go, well, it's not surprising if duct tape came out of this house that other people's hair might be on it or burlap. But that's a key element. I mean, other cases, people have been indicted for far less.
Yeah, Eric, do you think that is going to make an impact on the case or not?
I mean, certainly the plaintiff in the wrongful death case is going to say, you want a connection between Asa and the murders? Here is a demonstrable physical connection. Now, the reason that those hairs were on there is certainly debatable. But it just further ties her to these hellacious acts and is not terribly helpful for her in terms of this wrongful death case.
Is there, when we talk about her knowing, I mean, as simple terms as I can use as a layperson, like, did she know or did she know? You know, like, knowing is Rex has a private space in the basement that we don't go into. And they respect it, whatever reason, they don't ask questions. And no would be Rex has a private space in a basement with murder manuals. Like, those are two different knowings. Like, you both know. Knowing knows things to a greater degree. And at the end of the day, I mean, that's information that only she knows as far as what her knowledge was. I mean, from the outset and from what she said, it appears to be just knowing that he had a place, not no knowing. But that's something that's going to be very interesting and litigated here in a civil case, which is open to discoveries, open to depositions. What sort of evidence do you think they're going to be looking for? What sort of things might not, what sort of pitfalls here does Asa have to be looking out for in a civil case when people are looking for things that may look very incriminating, but look, if you're just kind of ignorant to what the hell's going on around you, may not truly be.
Good question.
You know, I think one thing that's going to come up is the digital forensics. And so, you know, anyone who's been married, you often text or email with your spouse, and sometimes that's about issues or concerns or problems that might be arising. And I'm wondering if there are any, and I don't know that there are, I'm not saying that these things exist, but there could be, texts where Asa's like, hey, what were you doing last night? You said you were going to do X, but that's not true. What's going on? And then I saw something weird downstairs. What is that? I'm just wondering if there are these little tidbits that could come up in a deposition about which you could be examined and say, hey, that's suspicion, isn't it? That's you thought something was up, didn't you? That's why you sent those messages. Now, again, I don't have any record that those such exact messages exist, but I'm wondering if during the digital forensic investigation, there might be hints and clues that Asa received and acted upon. And if so, does that prove knowledge, or does that prove at least some modicum of knowledge? It might.
You know, it's interesting because the defense team has been very adamant about that. You know, the prosecutor researched this, the investigators researched it. She's never been charged, never been a suspect in any of this. Which I believe, because I just think she was groomed into this position without wittingness, whether it's by conscious choice or not. I think that's what we're debating here or questioning. I'm curious about, she's created this special. They had the film crew covering her, and she always referred to him as her knight in shining armor. Does her public persona and the things that she put out in the public about her viewpoint of him help or hinder her, do you think, in this offense, or have nothing really to do with it?
I think on the balance, they probably help her in the wrongful death case, because it's you know, if you believe that those statements are accurate and those are her true beliefs, then it kind of shows that she might have been just delusional or at least in the dark, or at least, had convinced herself that, hey, this is, like you said, this is my knight in shining armor. And that's not really an impression you would have about a person if you had actual knowledge that they're out murdering a bunch of escorts. So I think, generally speaking, it is consistent with her position that she didn't know what happened. And that will sort of bolster her credibility of the wrongful death case, potentially.
Do you think her playing the like I'm a victim also role helps her? Because that's kind of what it's kind of like, looking like it might be set up as. Is that the role you think she should take?
I think that for the wrongful death piece, that would certainly help. You know, she can, instead of aligning herself with Hurriman, which is sort of what the wrongful death case is trying to do, they're trying to say, hey, you are at least some a part of this in some fashion. If she can distance herself from him, if she can show that there was a chasm between the two and that there was mistreatment or bad feelings, I think that sort of contrasts her from Rex Hurriman and puts her on the side of sort of the victims.
She did divorce him quickly.
That would be a compelling narrative potentially.
Yeah, she did divorce him quickly, which I think probably helps her too.
She did, but in the documentary, she said the reason why she did it was to protect assets. It wasn't because she didn't love him. You know, so there's that. But again, I agree. I mean, it can further argue her case of being bamboozled just like everybody else. And it'd be very difficult to litigate. How stupid are you? I'm not trying to be crass on her, but it's but I mean, it is. I mean, it really kind of is. It's like, okay, here's the, you know, would a reasonable person have suspected your husband might be a murderer if... And that's kind of the game that's going to be played here. And it's going to be up to a jury going, well, I think if I was in this situation and my husband might be a murderer, if, you know, survey says in the basement, he's doing this. And like the board lights up with all these things that she was aware of, then it's a game of how stupid are you? You know, were you really, did you really not think anything was going on here? Or is it, are you that cognitively distorted and you're able to tell yourself these things and compartmentalize Rex over here and you over here? And if you just don't look at it close enough, you really don't know what the hell's going on down there, which people do. And it's not being stupid. I'm being crass there, but it's an ability that our brains have sometimes to not see exactly what's in front of us. But again, a very hard thing to litigate one way or the other at the end of the day. Do you think this thing actually makes it to a jury? Or do you think something like this will get thrown out at some point?
Or pled? I was curious about
pled,
that, too.
Yeah,
you know, I think that the wrongful death laws, I totally understand how a victim's family is trying to explore any legal avenue they can to rectify this and bring some kind of remedy to them. That being said, I think the suit is a bit of a stretch legally. I think they're going to have to prove that the wife knew or should have known of these killings, and that also that she should have taken some different action that she didn't take, and further that they're going to have to get past what's called an intervening cause. So they have to prove that her actions or inactions caused the death of these folks. Doesn't have to be the only cause, but it usually has to be a substantial factor. And if there's an intervening cause, like you're married to a crazy serial killer, that intervening cause might win the day. A jury might say, hey, these were Rex's actions. These weren't Asa's actions. She was caught up in this. I think the lawsuit's a bit of a stretch.
I just want to follow up on, and I'm sorry, Tony. You said something interesting there. She should have known. Can she be convicted of this if she should have known?
So it'll depend exactly on the jury instructions in that jurisdiction. But typically, in a wrongful death case, you can prevail on negligence. So it can you can prevail on an intentional killing, but you can also prevail on a negligent killing, which means that either she knew or she should have known. A reasonable person in her circumstances would have known and would have done something different, would have talked to police, would have warned people, who knows. Yes, I think that's a potential ground on which she could be found liable. But still, I think there are a lot of other issues that are going to make it really difficult for the plaintiff.
Right.
Yeah. Even though we got the guilty plea that he's coming in with, it's still there's still a lot to be litigated here. And I think we probably have more bodies to be accounted for as well. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue the conversation there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts so you don't miss any of our continued coverage on this and the many cases that we watch for you right here. Let's move over to another conversation that doesn't seem to die. Joseph Duggar allegedly confessed to abusing a 9-year-old girl. His wife, Kendra, also arrested on separate charges days later. Their children are reportedly in state custody now. And the family that went to law enforcement is now allegedly facing retaliation from people connected to the Duggars. That's an online allegation that's floating around out there, unconfirmed by us, but it is in the ether of discussion. So we're going to discuss it for what it is. It is allegations. And that's what we're going to say today is we cannot confirm it being factual, but there's these allegations that are floating around. If what's being described is accurate, the legal exposure here goes well beyond one man and one charge. Joining us to have this discussion, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, and as always, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. Eric, people close to this family, allegations are floating all over the place right now, saying that there had been basically coercive control going on in this relationship for quite a time leading up to this arrest. Kendra essentially being isolated from her parents, from her family. The allegations say that he or people within the family were trying to turn her away from her family, that they were wicked, turning her against the support system that might be able to say, there's something weird going on here with these folks. If that pattern holds up, and the fact that she now has her own charges against her, can coercive control, I mean, that is litigated in some places, can that become part of this criminal case? And does it give Kendra a viable defense should she choose to step out of the umbrella of the Duggars and take charge of her own damn life?
So, Tony, there is a well-established defense that is called duress. And, yeah, and it's, I think it's related to this concept of coercive control, because, you know, really the idea under duress is that a person practically did not have an option, or did not feel they had an option to do something different. And this arises a lot of times when you have these sort of power differentials and these dynamics where one person is sort of subservient to the other and is in fact being, you know, restricted and constrained by the other person. And so could that be a partial basis for a duress defense? Absolutely. That's really the heart of and a predicate of a duress defense. Now, there's more that would be required, but certainly going in that direction.
So here's a semantics question I have on this duress, Eric. So I've just been, as everyone knows, I love reading and consuming the information behind these Nutter groups. And I've just started reading Holy Disruptor by Amy Duggar King, the niece of Michelle and Jim Bob. And she outlines in the first chapter the rules, regulations, and how this whole system of IBLP works. It's a really, really fascinating read. So I'm curious, when it comes to duress, they are very, very practiced at not saying, I will do this, I will do this in reciprocity for your actions. And so that's an easy thing to put in court. But what they do is they put it on God's lap. They say, if you act in this manner, well, then you're falling outside the umbrella of protection, and God is going to potentially burn down your house, blow up your car, it's just kill, like, your kids. I mean,
it's like
whatever it is.
Something bad's going to happen.
Right. Something bad's going to happen, but I'm not going to do it. God's going to do it. And so how does that methodology, is that defensible, not defensible? I mean, how does the religious doctrine of Nutter come into play here when you're trying to say it was duress or not duress?
Yeah, you know, I think the central inquiry is the control piece. Did someone else, in effect, make Kendra do something? And whether that's through, you know, their own personal threats or saying, I'm going to do something, or whether that's through a veiled or vague or indirect threat that something else bad is going to happen to you. I don't think that distinction is going to absolve Joseph Duggar, and nor would it divest Kendra of a potential defense in this case. So the fact that he's using spiritual language, that might even be more compelling. That might even be more of a reason to someone who is spiritually inclined to go along with what someone else wants them to do. So it could even make the defense stronger.
Good. Good.
The Caldwells, that's Kendra's maiden name. That's her family. There's another storyline that's starting to develop out of this case. And again, these are allegations that are floating around on the internet. And I want to preface this at that. I can't confirm these things, but there's a lot of tea leaves, and it's going beyond tea leaves now. Caldwells have a GoFundMe out there. They first put one up. They pulled it down. They put it back up. It's basically a legal defense fund that they have put up now, not really going into any great detail as to why they need a legal defense fund and housing fund. I'm sorry, it's a housing fund. The new version of it that just went up last night, as of this recording, says they're not using those funds for their legal fees. They need it for housing. Why do they need it for housing? Well, the allegations are this. After Joseph's arrest, the allegation is someone... don't know who it is, acting on behalf of the power of attorney, cut utilities to the home where the victim's family was living, allegedly.
Didn't know God could cut utilities, did you?
I know. And they're
fell under that umbrella.
Also being evicted. Kendra and Joseph joke about this in one of their phone calls the Caldwells are going to be held accountable to get out of the house. Kendra's very much, it feels like, I would, for lack of a better term, brainwashed right now to be on the side of the Duggars. And they're being love bombed and being told, you know, her family, in my opinion, that, you know, her family is icky in some sort of a way. These charges for Joseph go back almost 6 years. The issues between the Caldwells and the Duggars seem to stem back around these time periods. And again, pure speculation as to what the hell's going on here. But if we were to say, if we were to find that someone was trying to exercise a lever of power, and again, I'm not saying they did, I'm saying if someone was trying to exercise a lever of power of someone's housing, security, safety, income, professional life, someone was trying to take that away, control that, basically instill negative consequences for exposing this crime, for going to authorities. If you do this, we're going to do that. We're going to retaliate against you for doing what is legally required of you to do to report this crime. But if you do that, we're going to do that. Not saying that happened, but if that did, if that can be traced back, if there can be documentation of that, is that another crime that another large group of folks who made those certain calls might be accountable for trying to withhold that information to get to authorities?
I mean, if hypothetically someone revealed the crimes of another person, and then that suspect took measures, whether by themselves or through an intermediary, to harm the individual who caused that revelation, that is textbook victim intimidation. It is textbook witness tampering. And those are, in nearly all jurisdictions, felonies, and very serious ones as well. And on top of that, it really casts even a darker shadow, if that's possible, on the Duggar allegations, in that not only was there this alleged egregious, unspeakable conduct with a minor, but then trying to cover it up and then trying to harm, someone who brought this to the attention of authorities, I think it could be a big problem for Duggar.
So now also going back to how they create this entire IBLP around this doctrine of control, does it help or hinder? And I'm guessing it's going to hinder, it's going to be anti-Duggar on this one, that this is a type of language that this religious crazy has been doing for a long time. In other words, they didn't just use this kind of language of veiled threats and violence for this case. This is what they've been doing for years and years. This is just their indoctrination. Look, it's in all our manuals. It's in all our pamphlets. The children aren't educated. The children are indoctrinated into this mindset of how, in other words, they don't have to use this direct language. To your earlier point, does that actually make it better for, for prosecuting them on this?
I think it's a piece that cannot be ignored. I think when you're presenting the entirety of a case as a prosecutor, you have to talk about these precursors. You have to talk about these ideological underpinnings and how they might have influenced the alleged acts. And so I don't think the prosecutors can sidestep around it. I think they have to go at it and explain it to the jury for what they believe it is and how they believe it's connected to the case.
Yeah, good.
Saying this goes to trial, let's just say it does, and I don't know that it will, but let's say it does get there. does, if Joseph Duggar were to decide to break ranks from his family, right now it doesn't certainly appear that way, but let's just say in the next however many years it takes for this to go to trial, if it does, that he's influenced, he has a change of heart, somebody gets to him, he wakes up and realizes, you know what, I might have a better chance fighting this if I share how brainwashed I was through my family and basically having a second grade education and not being educated beyond Gothard's workbooks. And we were never taught sex ed. We never taught this. Granted, he is a grown ass adult, but context does mean a lot. And if one could be able to show lack of education, lack of understanding, lack of consequence to actions. I mean, I'm not saying it would absolve him of anything, but I'm wondering if that would be something that could be brought up in a sentencing time or something of that nature to go, he had limited capabilities to a certain extent. I mean, is that an argument in the real world should he want to go down and pull that lever for his own well-being?
Oh, 100%. While it might not be a delineated statutory defense written in the law books, those aren't the only types of defense that are brought during jury trials. You know, you're dealing with lay people as jurors. And so certainly I think it would make sense for the Duggars for Joseph Duggar to raise that theme and to tell this jury that, you know, did that affect his ability to form a mental state? Did it affect his ability to knowingly do something that he knew was wrong? Well, when you're completely brainwashed, I'm not going to bat for the guy, but I'm saying at the trial, certainly I think a jury would want to hear about that. And could that influence how a jury views the case, how they view guilt or innocence? It certainly could.
It'll be interesting. You know, and to your point, I don't think I see Joseph right now, you know, to look at some of the comments too, breaking ranks with dad because he's seeing this as his prison ministry that's coming up.
Yeah, the case is young though.
Right. Until if he gets convicted and he gets, you know, again, all hypothetical and, you know, innocent till proven guilty, but this all sounds well and good when he's in isolation for 23 hours a day. Wait till the child abuser gets to general population and tries to create a ministry.
Wait till he meets the broomsticks.
See how that runs on him.
Yeah. That might
Sorry, I digressed.
So well. No. I want to talk about the Jill Duggar has written publicly about the NDAs that restricted the adult children from speaking about the family. Jill, one of the survivors of the Duggar. Because, I mean, let's be honest, that's what she is. She is a survivor of that family. And sometimes when people get those titles, it's like survivor. Yeah. You are. When you're coming out of that sort of a coercively controlled group of folks, in my opinion, you are a survivor. Sources describe a broader system where one person allegedly controlled the housing, the jobs, the contracts of everyone around him, and punished anyone who pushed back. When that kind of structure is now connected to an active criminal case, how enforceable are those NDAs? I mean, how enforceable are Jim Bob's NDAs to begin with at the end of the day? When you're talking about, you know, telling your kids they can't talk about their own lives, their own childhood, their own upbringing, their identity. You're not allowed to do that because it might make dad look bad or mom look bad or the IBLP or Duggarville look bad. Is that something you can, I mean, it seems insane to be able to give your kids an NDA or make them sign something like that to not be able to talk about their own lives. Is that truly an enforceable contract?
You know, it's a keen legal insight because, like you just said, an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, is a contract. It's a contract between two people. And so contract law governs it. And one thing that exists in contract law is that if there is a provision that is against public policy, then it can void that provision. Sometimes it can void the entire contract.
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, some contracts, some NDAs saying, hey, you cannot discuss what happened in your childhood. If that involved criminal activity, you can't restrict somebody contractually from disclosing criminal activity. And so, you know, certainly some of the more egregious things that may have gone on, I don't think the NDA can stop anybody from disclosing those if they do rise to the level of criminal conduct. So, yeah, I'm not sure how enforceable those are. And who knows? We might hear a lot more.
That, and it's the religion. It is IBLP. Part of that indoctrination that Amy's talking about in her book is that children are considered property of the father and to be used as resources for them at all points. And so this is just their legalized version of what their religion teaches, and that you just don't communicate outside of the authority of the father. They are completely outlawed from doing it, or suffer the wrath of God, taking your car, burning down your house, and all these things. Oh my God.
Obviously, we didn't live with the Duggars, but off the top of my head, I can think of several things that, in my opinion, would classify as illegal activity that would have occurred during their upbringing. You know, let's just say, if it's true that they didn't get educated beyond a second grade level, most of that, like one, I think two have GEDs, if that is correct. Mm-hmm. I could be off on that, but I believe it's very few of them actually finished any sort of formal education. That could be looked at as child abuse, right? There, in my opinion. So you got that. I mean, I'm sure there's a gazillion other things, in my opinion, that could possibly be out there that one could look at and go, okay, we're not supposed to talk about this. And if that is illegal, meaning it would be criminal, does that then void the whole damn contract? Even if there is a little stipulation and they're like, even if one part of this is found to be void, the rest is enforceable. If would this, in all likelihood, to any Duggar out there who's listening to this right now, looking for a lifeline or a modicum of hope that you can get the fuck out of this shit show, clearly some of the sisters got out. They also didn't sign the contract. But if you signed it and you're sitting there worrying, oh my God, if I come out of this, I mean, do they really have much to worry about at the end of the day? And quite honestly, a GoFundMe, I bet you could fill your legal fees like that, yeah, with the world willing to support you getting out of this.
Totally. To supplement what I was saying earlier, not only can an NDA not prohibit a person from disclosing criminal activity, it probably cannot prohibit a person from disclosing other unlawful activity, even if it's not criminal. Mm-hmm. Actions that might violate laws requiring kids to go to school.
Yeah.
Have other sort of peripheral unlawful issues attendant to them. I think that there is a severability clause, which is what you're talking about, where mm-hmm. it says like, hey, even if this one provision is void, the other ones are active, that might have legal effect. But if a judge were to look at the NDA and say, hey, when I'm looking at this, this prohibits so much disclosure of, you know, unlawful acts that just as a whole, the bulk of it is void as to public policy, the whole thing could be thrown out. So I'm not sure how much these Duggars would have to worry about should they feel compelled to come forward with information about stuff that could be unlawful.
I also wonder about the child labor laws that might have been violated as well, because even right. years ago, they sent Josh away to basically work camp to rid him of his immoral thoughts when he was abusing his sisters. And I wonder the ages of the kids that got sent away to these work camps, as I'm calling them, the internment camps for correctional thinking. I wonder how that's going to play in as well. And just all our experiments on it.
And then you got statute of limitations and all that that plays in there. But I mean, at the end of the day, I wonder how, because again, these, and I'm not saying this as an insult, these are not bright people. These are people who were brainwashed from birth, these 19 kids and counting. And some, the ones who've escaped, have educated themselves. There's plenty that have not. They don't see things in the full spectrum of reality that the rest of us on the outside world do. They don't have the equipment to do it. They don't have the reps to do it. They don't have the experience to even understand that they have this autonomy and ability because they've been brainwashed this way their entire lives. And so I do wonder how much, you know, how much Jim Bob has that NDA that he holds over people's heads. This is just my speculation of like, well, if you do that, then I'm going to do this. And it's just spoken of as if the laws will simply follow what he says and what he believes is on this piece of paper, when in reality, a judge may look at it and go tell him to go F himself. But if you're that close and that's all you know, you're probably going to believe Jim Bob because, you know, he's been right on so many things. But in that ecosystem, he has.
Yeah, totally. And I think, along those lines, what sense would these kids have of rights? Like, do they even know, like, what a right is?
Exactly.
I think within that family system and the larger religious model, it's not about, like, individual rights and what someone has the freedom to do. It's about compliance. It's about obedience. And so when you have that as sort of your only prism through which you view life, do you even know that you can speak out? Do you even know that you can advocate for yourself? I'm not sure.
You can't, because they're literally indoctrinated, not taught. They're taught and indoctrinated into the father is everything. Even when you get married, and that's what Jill was talking about in her book, even after marriage, the father has full control of absolutely everything. And they will fight you tooth and nail of it. And if you fight it, then you're going against the brethren. If you go against the brethren, you're outside the umbrella, and God's going to smite you for everything you do in life. Oh, my God, what a system.
Yeah, I guess I would say to anybody that's in there, are you really happy? How's this working out for you?
Well, if you're not happy, then you're going to create a great ministry about how you're not happy. It gives you a chance to redeem yourself. See what I mean? It's a cyclical, crazy thinking. Yeah,
it is. It is. But there is a way out to any of them that are watching this. And just so you know, you got pretty much the support of the world. I have yet to see Duggar supporters on anything. I've yet to see anybody stand up for anything with the Duggars on anything that we've put out. Usually, even Koberger has supporters. Like, I don't see any here. And I'm sure some exist in some dark corner of the internet. But that says something to me when you have that much support in the Caldwells and their GoFundMe also has been getting quite a bit.
It's because there's child abuse involved. Anytime you have child abuse, who's going to line up with the abuser?
Exactly. So anyway, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love to get your feedback. Again, these are allegations, innocent till proven guilty. All the people we talked about, innocent till proven guilty. Some not charged with anything. Again, all a lot of speculation and opinion here. So we'd love to get your thoughts there in the comments, Substack, YouTube. Press subscribe wherever you're listening to us so you don't miss any of our commentary and discussions wherever you're listening. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Robin's book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever books are sold. Go check it out. Until next time, for Robin and Eric and Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.